Hello, and welcome back to another broadcast of For Good Reason. My name is Bruce Harris. Our goal is to bring you intelligent and even more critically diverse opinion that diverges from approved orthodoxy. This program will air on the second Thursday of every month at noon and will be rebroadcast 2 days later on Saturday at 7 p.m. I'll be reading today from National Review. This is dated September 30th, 2019. The issue fundamentally focuses on gun control, and I'll be reading at least one article about that topic. So let's begin. The article is titled "Armed Citizen," subtitled "Americans Defend Themselves with Guns Probably Hundreds of Thousands of Times Each Year." The article is written by Robert Verbruggen. And so it begins. One day at 5:30 a.m., a man with a machete hacked at two doors, leaving a trail of broken glass to force his way into a DeKalb County, Georgia home. What he planned to accomplish once inside, though, we'll never know. The homeowner had a gun, confronted the intruder, and fired two shots, killing him. This is what's known as a defensive gun use, or DGU. It is abundantly clear that such things happen regularly in this country, which should not surprise us. We have 323 million people, at least as many guns, and plenty of crime. So periodically, a person will use a gun to stop a crime. The National Rifle Association's Armed Citizen Report, from which the case is drawn, compiles several incidents each week from local news stories. But exactly how many times do things like this happen each year? Often enough to provide a big potential upside to buying a gun? Often enough question that we should worry about various proposed gun control measures reducing the number? It turns out it's a lot harder to count DGUs, and again that was defensive gun use, than it is to count, say, murders, each of which leaves a dead body and almost without fail attracts attention from the authorities. And thus the issue has been hotly disputed among researchers for decades. Perhaps the simplest approach is to conduct a survey asking people whether they've used a gun defensively within some preceding time period. Most famously, a survey conducted in 1993 by Gary Cleek and Mark Gertz estimated that more than 1% of American adults had used a gun defensively in the past year. This implied something on the order of 2.2 to 2.5 million defensive gun uses annually. Several other surveys conducted around the same time suggest roughly the same thing, including one effort by the Center for Disease Control that went unpublicized until Kleck stumbled upon the data in 2018, 2 decades after the questions had been asked. Especially noteworthy is that while some DGUs, defensive gun uses, can be quite dramatic, the FBI reports that of the 50 active shooter incidents in 2016 and 2017, armed citizens stopped four and intervened unsuccessfully in two more. One civilian was wounded. The other scared the attacker off to a new location where he continued shooting. Most don't involve firing the gun. So most of these incidents do not involve firing the gun. Producing a weapon is usually enough to scare off your run-of-the-mill lowlife. But these are old studies, and it's not obvious what a survey like this would say today. Crime has fallen drastically since the 1990s, and gun ownership has dipped by some measures as well. However, gun owners today are more likely to own handguns instead of rifles and shotguns, and also far more likely to have concealed carry permits, thanks to the spread of liberal shall-issue laws in small but growing numbers of states, a permit isn't even required. Some call it gun culture 2.0, less focus on hunting, more on self-defense, and carrying in public. And there are serious objections to these surveys aside from their age, the largest of which is that when you're trying to estimate a very low proportion, which by all accounts the share of Americans who use a gun in self-defense each year is, the potential for overestimation is much higher than that for underestimation. For example, if the true number is 0.5%, underestimation can result from wrong answers by just 0.5% of the respondents, while overestimation can result from wrong answers by 99.5%. There are reasons that both groups might answer incorrectly, but the fact that one group is so much bigger than the other makes these risks lopsided. Further, as the RAND Corporation pointed out in a recent review of gun violence literature, if these survey results are accurate, a lot of gunshot injuries can an implausibly high number, arguably, are not resulting in deaths or hospital visits. The Gleck and Gertz estimates suggest that while using a firearm for self-defense, U.S. residents likely injured or killed an opponent 207,000 times per year, but only about 100,000 people die or are treated for gunshot injuries in hospitals each year, most of whom either shot themselves or were victims of criminal assaults. Kleck has defended his work in great detail for a quarter of a century now, but 2 million is probably too high. Is there a more accurate method? Some anti-gun researchers have relied instead on the National Crime Victimization Survey, NCVS. As the name suggests, the survey asks Americans about their experiences with crime. It also asks some victims what, if anything, they did to resist. Research with this survey produces drastically lower results. Maybe 100,000 DGUs, that was again defensive gun uses, a year, even fewer in some studies. But if Kleck's style surveys have a high risk of overstating defensive gun uses, the NCVS obviously produces an underestimate. It doesn't ask all of the respondents whether they defended themselves against a crime. In order to get to that question, folks have to report in the course of answering screener questions that they were the victim of crimes or attempted crimes involving personal contact. Among the potentially excluded respondents, RAND notes, are those reporting incidents involving other crimes, e.g. trespassing, commercial crimes. Victims of crimes in the included categories who did not report those crimes earlier in the interview and those and those reporting incidents that were not completed crimes, e.g. suspected crimes. On top of that, respondents are simply asked what they did in response to the crime. They are not asked specifically about gun use. It seems fair to treat the NCVS estimates as a floor and Kleck's as a ceiling, which gives us a range of about 100,000 to 2 million DGUs per year. With such a wide range, unfortunately, we can't even say whether defensive gun uses outnumber criminal ones, which the NCVS estimates at around 500,000 per year these days, down from 2 to 3 times that in the early to mid-1990s when Kleck surveys took place. And of course, none of this should minimize the fact that guns are used quite often as a tool for evil. I'll read that again. And of course, none of this should minimize the fact that guns are used quite often as a tool for evil. When it comes to lethal uses of guns, for instance, the criminal ones clearly outnumbered the defensive ones. For 2017, the FBI records 299 justifiable firearm homicides by civilians versus 10,982 murders and non-negligent manslaughters with guns. The former number is underestimated by a variety of technical reasons, but that's an enormous gap. And there are tens of thousands of gun suicides each year as well on the con side of the balance sheet. So what should gun owners and those thinking about joining us make of all this? However imprecise the numbers may be, we can certainly dismiss claims that guns are practically never useful for self-defense. Guns are used in self-defense probably hundreds of thousands of times per year. Key theme. Beyond the aggregate data, we must look to our individual circumstances, the crime rates in neighborhoods we live in, whether we have to travel at night in dangerous areas, whether we've been threatened, our mental health, our criminal history and anger issues, our shooting abilities and training, and so on. All else equal, the greater the threats we face, the less our likelihood of misusing a gun ourselves, and the less the likelihood of us of our misusing our gun ourselves. And the greater our ability to deal with a threat effectively, the more likely it is that the benefits of gun ownership will outweigh the risks. Some of us will quite rationally decide that we're safer with a gun than without, however infuriating this may be to those who would minimize the value of bearing arms. End of article. Our second article, titled Heller's Precarious Situation, subtitled Many Courts Are Failing to Uphold the Second Amendment. This article is written by David B. Koppel, K-O-P-E-L. The Supreme Court's 2008 District of Columbia versus Heller decision affirmed that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to arms. 2 years later, McDonald versus Chicago made that right enforceable against state and local governments. The McDonald Court declared that the Second Amendment is not a second-class right to be singled out for special and specially unfavorable treatment. In 2019, however, Heller is in a precarious situation. There have been numerous victories for gun rights, but many lower courts have in practice nullified the Second Amendment. Later this year, the Supreme Court may hear a case involving egregious Second Amendment infringements by the New York City government. The court should take the opportunity not only to strike New York's abuses, but also to firmly remind lower courts that the Second Amendment is a first-class civil right. Before Heller, Washington, D.C. banned handguns and required that long guns be stored in an inoperable state, rendering them useless for self-defense. Today, D.C. citizens not only may defend their homes and families with handguns or long guns, but also may carry handguns in public. The D.C. handgun carry licensing system is not perfect, but it does provide a fair path for applicants who pass safety training and a fingerprint-based background check, thanks to the D.C. Circuit's 2017 decision in Wren versus the District of Columbia. Heller and McDonald ended handgun bans in Chicago and six of its suburbs. Then in 2012, the Seventh Circuit in Moore versus Madigan struck down Illinois' statewide ban on carrying guns in public. Now, Illinoisians, like residents of D.C. and most of the rest of the nation, can bear arms lawfully. When the D.C. City Council banned handguns in 1975, followed by Chicago and its suburbs in the 1980s, the stated purpose was to build momentum for national prohibition. In 1994, pollster Lou Harris confidently predicted that handguns would be outlawed within 2 or 3 years. That was in 1994. Today, handgun bans are effectively off the table. The 2016 election preserved and fortified the court's 5-4 pro-Second Amendment majority, and in some cases at least, the lower courts have proven willing to enforce Heller. In some states and cities, for example, xenophobic laws prohibited legal resident aliens from obtaining handgun carry permits or even possessing firearms at all. From Hawaii to Massachusetts, those laws have been struck down. The most recent case ended the refusal of Riverside County, California, to let aliens apply for concealed carry permits. All courts have upheld the 1968 federal ban on arms possession by illegal aliens. Under President George H.W. Bush, the Department of Housing and Urban Development had encouraged housing authorities to include gun bans in their lease conditions. The Chicago Housing Authority enforced its ban with warrantless home searches until a federal court in 1994 ordered it to desist. Post-Heller, most housing authorities have voluntarily removed these unconstitutional conditions. Those that persist always lose in court, most recently in April, in a case involving the East St. Louis Housing Authority. Further, the Second Amendment protects arms, not just firearms, as the Supreme Court affirmed in 2016's Catano versus Massachusetts, a terse per curiam opinion overturning a decision that had upheld the state's ban on electric stun guns. Since then, almost all state and local stun gun bans have been repealed or held unconstitutional. Still clinging to bans are Hawaii and Rhode Island, plus Wilmington, Delaware, and some smaller towns. Also declared unconstitutional laws have been New York State's ban on nunchucks and Connecticut's ban on transporting a police baton when moving it to a new home. But in other areas, results are mixed. Bans on switchblade knives, folding knives that automatically open when a spring is released, were struck down in Wisconsin, but upheld in New Mexico. Because lawful commerce in arms is essential for Second Amendment rights, federal courts ruled against gun store bans in Chicago and one of its suburbs. But Alameda County, California, bans all new gun stores within its jurisdiction, and the Ninth Circuit en banc held that the ban does not even raise a Second Amendment issue. Worse, the right to bear, i.e. carry arms, is almost wholly denied in Hawaii, Maryland, and New Jersey. The same is true in many cities or counties in California, New York, Delaware, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. These bans have been upheld by federal circuit courts, and so far the Supreme Court has not taken any opportunities to review them. Justice Thomas and Gorsuch dissented from denial of certiorari in a 2017 California case, Peruto versus San Diego. A pending New Jersey case, Roger versus Gruwall, gives the Supreme Court another chance to address the problem. This is not the only area where the lower courts have failed and the Supreme Court has refused to correct them. Perhaps because of uncertainty about what Justice Kennedy would do, the court has done little with Second Amendment jurisprudence since McDonald. In the Ninth Circuit, district judges or three-judge appellate panels sometimes rule in favor of Second Amendment rights, but no rights-affirming decision has survived en banc review. Thus, in a circuit that covers over 20% of the U.S. population, it is permissible to require that handguns in the home be locked up when not being worn, so that a person who is sleeping or bathing cannot have a functional handgun available. Likewise, a 10-day waiting period may be imposed on gun buyers who have just passed a background check and who already own another gun. The Supreme Court denied cert in cases challenging these policies, drawing dissent from Justice Thomas and Scalia in the first and from Justice Thomas in the latter, Scalia having passed away by then. Most egregiously, California now effectively bans all handgun models that have debuted since 2013 via a mandate that new handguns micro-stamp their serial number in two locations on every unit of ammunition the handgun fires. Double micro-stamping to California's specifications is impossible. Neither in a test lab nor anywhere else has anyone been able to comply with the law. A certiorari petition in a case challenging this law, Penna versus Horan, is currently pending before the Supreme Court. The Seventh Circuit and several others have upheld bans on magazines that hold more than 10 rounds and on many common rifles, including the AR-15. The Supreme Court's cert denial in a case challenging one of these laws, Friedman versus City of Highland Park, drew stinging dissents from Justice Thomas and Scalia, detailing how bans on common arms, typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes, violate Heller's express language. The Second Circuit is worst of all. Anti-gun rights decisions often have dissenting opinions in other circuits, but never in the Second. Consider the case currently before the U.S. Supreme Court, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City. A New York City police regulation forbade residents to take their handguns out of the city. A resident of Staten Island could not participate at a range in New Jersey, attend a training class in New Hampshire, or shoot at a competition in Connecticut. Nor could she possess her handgun for protection when traveling in another state in compliance with that state's laws. The Second Circuit said that the travel ban probably does not even raise a Second Amendment issue. Even if the Second Amendment were involved, said the circuit panel, the ban could be upheld based solely on a vague and unsubstantiated affidavit from a police official who speculated with no evidence about road rage shootings. Normally, when faced with a limitation on a constitutional right, courts are supposed to consider whether there are less burdensome alternatives or substantially less burdensome means of achieving the government's purpose. Courts must also consider whether the plaintiffs have rebutted the government's evidence, and courts must not let the government get away with speculation or shoddy data or no data at all. But when the Second Amendment is at issue, the Second Circuit jettisons the normal standards of judicial review. This spring, once the Supreme Court had granted certiorari in the New York City case, lawyers on all sides of the gun issue recognized that the travel ban was indefensible under ordinary constitutional standards. Some anti-gun groups, such as Brady and Giffords, know better than to defend the travel ban. Their Supreme Court amicus briefs, filed in support of neither party, primarily argued that the court should not recognize any right to carry arms for protection. Mayor de Blasio's administration has been desperately attempting to stop the court from hearing the case for fear of a broad ruling on the right to arms. De Blasio's appointees partially modified the anti-travel regulation and the anti-gun state government enacted, and the anti-gun state government enacted a law partially preempting such regulations. The city lawyers argue that the case is moot because the city has now desisted from its abuses. Mootness doctrine is intricate, and perhaps this ploy will succeed. The court will decide whether to proceed with the case on October 1 at its long conference. Regardless, the legal record is clear. The Second Circuit unanimously and flippantly upheld an extremist gun control policy without a scintilla of empirical support. And the Second Circuit's opinion was no aberration, but was typical of the massive resistance to Heller that is coming from too many lower courts. The Supreme Court needs to exert leadership, reaffirm that Heller and McDonald meant what they said, and rein in lower court defiance of constitutional rights. If the justices decide that mootness doctrine prevents them from doing so in the New York City case, there are plenty of others to choose from. End of article. From the same issue of the National Review, I will be reading a couple of shorter notes to complete our time. Amazon rainforest fires set off a social media firestorm as actors, soccer players, and the president of France warned that the lungs, which produce 20% of our planet's oxygen, Macron's words, were burning up. That's wrong. Or as climate scientist Dan Nepstad put it in Forbes, BS. I won't say the word. They have it spelled out in this edition. The Amazon uses just as much oxygen in respiration as it produces. How about the notion propagated by the international press that owing to climate change, the rainforest was burning at record rates? Also wrong. The number of forest fires in Brazil peaked in the mid-2000s, though the rate is rising as farmers clear land and the Jair Bolsonaro administration rolls back environmental protections. We obviously don't want to see the Amazon disappear, but it'd be nice if the overheated rhetoric did. Item 2. Like many conflicts, the great chicken sandwich war of 2019 was ultimately decided by logistics. Popeye unleashed a surprise Twitter attack on Chick-fil-A, which was initially shaken but rallied its troops. In the end, Popeye's had to surrender after its supply lines had failed and it had run out of chicken. Like everything else these days, the struggle acquired a political dimension. The left felt compelled to root for Popeye's, partly because of its urban, multicultural vibe and partly because of the conservatism of Chick-fil-A's founder, which in turn earned Chick-fil-A support from the right, while Vox, V-O-X, declared both sides to be evil because fast food workers are underpaid. Whatever one's view of it, the result was that for a few weeks, Americans ate a lot more chicken. Hey, wait, you don't think that was the idea all along, do you? Item 3. Around 150 parents and pupils protested outside a high school in Sussex, England, on account of the school's enforced gender-neutral uniforms, which were introduced to in an attempt to make transgender pupils feel more comfortable. Female students demanded the right to wear skirts instead of being forced to wear pants. Piers Morgan, a presenter of Good Morning Britain and an old friend of Donald Trump who attended the school when he was a teen, tweeted his support for, that is, Piers Morgan attended the school, tweeted his support for the protest. Morgan wrote that the school's policy was just one more episode in the gender-neutral craze. Teenage activism in response to transgender policies is also happening across the United States. For example, in March, 60 students walked out of Abraham Lincoln High School in Iowa after the school permitted biologically male students to use the female restroom. Perhaps it is no coincidence that in Hans Christian Andersen's tale, The Emperor's New Clothes, the person who brings the miserable sham to an end is a child. Item 4. The generally dismal conditions of New York City's public schools are redeemed by special programs for the gifted and talented. But now a committee has recommended eliminating them because the racial numbers don't come out right. This committee would condemn good students to inappropriately slow teaching in service of the illusory benefits of mixing outstanding students with everyone else. Mayor Bill de Blasio has given the plan a half-hearted endorsement but stopped short of enacting it. For educational reasons as well as ones of simple fairness, we hope he will remain unconvinced. Item 5. The College Board has dropped its controversial calculation for each student who takes the SAT of an adversity score, quantifying how much of a positive or negative factor the applicant's neighborhood and school have been. While in principle, there's nothing wrong with giving a break to students who have overcome tough backgrounds, the attempt to reduce someone's lifetime total of adversity to a single number was ill-considered from the start. The adversity score has been replaced by a dashboard of information about a student, dubbed a landscape for some reason. To be sure, different colleges place different emphasis on raw talent, diversity, geographical origin, family background, and so forth. And this new tool may reasonably help them do so, as long as they do not grant or withhold preference on the basis of race, a practice that is contrary to our nation's most deeply held principles. Last item. Protests in Hong Kong began on the last day of March and escalated during the summer. They are full-blown democracy protests. Their original cause was an extradition bill which would have sent Hong Kong people accused of a crime to the mainland. In the face of protests, the bill was suspended. Now it has been withdrawn. Perhaps authorities in Beijing wanted minimal trouble in the run-up to the big anniversary celebration on October 1. The dictatorship will mark its 70th anniversary. Perhaps they wanted to split the democracy movement between moderate elements and bolder ones. Most in the movement are pressing for more, including the direct election of those who govern them. The United States should express its solidarity with the democracy movement. We should warn that the communists will pay a price if they move on Hong Kong as they did against student protesters in Tiananmen Square 30 years ago. We have diplomatic, economic, and other levers. For example, the 2020 Winter Olympics are scheduled to take place in Beijing. Should they? Meanwhile, Hong Kong people are providing a stirring example of courage and democratic values. Well, I think that's all the time we have left today, but we'll be back in touch with you again next month. Remember, this program airs on the second Thursday of every month at noon and is rebroadcast 2 days later on Saturday at 7 p.m. If you have any comments or suggestions, we would love to hear from you here at Radio Reading Services. For now, take care and so long.